This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Want to know another Snapple fact? The first hot air balloon passengers were a sheep, a duck, and a rooster. Ridiculous. Check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavored Snapple near you.
Ho, 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 hello, and welcome back to Bah Humbug, the Christmas movies podcast that thinks a leg lamp could really tie this room together. I'm your host, Helen O'Hara, and today I'm going to be discussing the biggest controversy of this or any Christmas season. No, not whether Die Hard is a Christmas movie. It is, but ask yourself why you care so much. And not whether it's okay to open presents on Christmas Eve in this country, which is, in my view, being greedy unless you're Scandinavian or something and it's your family tradition. No, today we dare ask whether Richard Curtis's Love Actually is a warm, fuzzy, romantic Christmas story or a cold-hearted, dead-eyed monster of cynicism and sexism. It is the question that divides families, that divides friends, and that threatens all of our Christmases past, present and future, if not thrashed out once and for all. To help me delve deep into this film, I am delighted to be joined by two of my film journalist colleagues, Ollie Richards and James Dyer, who I've been working with basically since Love Actually came out, and who, I'm delighted to say, have not yet managed to lose my number. Here's what they had to say about this absolutely thorniest of Christmas issues. So, Ollie and James, welcome to Bah Humbug. Happy Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you.
Bah Humbug? I feel that's more on brand for me.
That is more on brand, which is why it's so, so surprising that you love Love Actually. And why the much more, like, less misanthropic Ollie really can't stand it. A little bit less.
See, I think this actually makes sense, and we'll get into this, because it's not a romantic film. So I think that's why James likes it, because it's very surface romantic. There's nothing actually genuinely emotional going on.
And that's just me in a nutshell, clearly.
There we go.
He's cracked it. End of podcast.
Interesting. Okay, you see, immediately, cards on the table, not romantic versus the Christmassiest thing in the world. James, why do you love it?
Because it's brilliant. I remember going to see this, whatever it was, Christmas 2003, I want to say. And I remember seeing it with my then boss, Catherine Hanley, and going in there and just sort of being filled with sort of festive joy and being sort of like touched by the romanticism of it and just loving every minute of it. Now, you have to understand, I am very much kind of, I am Richard Curtis's particular, so we say, schmaltzy shtick, which is a bit Marmite, and a lot of people really don't warm to it. I've always been a sucker for it. Like Notting Hill, absolutely. Like, I just gobble it all up. I can't get enough of it. And, you know, when he came up with this, he's like directing for the first time. And I was like, it's like Richard Curtis, but just the most Richard Curtis thing you've ever imagined, all in your face, all at once, with like 14 separate stories, all very. And I was just like, yes, please, give this to me now.
Only 10, of course, because they cut four of them out.
They did cut four of them out, that's quite right.
That's true. But you're right about the Richard Curtis-iness, because I was reminded last night when I rewatched it that, of course, it opens with Love Is All Around, aka Christmas Is All Around in this incarnation, which I have always thought, like, fair play, that's making fun of your own massive success with Four Weddings and a Funeral. So, you know, I appreciate that as a meta joke.
I like that also. It's partly like, isn't it the Chris Marshall storyline, which Ollie and I will 100% hold up. Like, the Chris Marshall storyline is fucking hateful. Like, there's no getting around it. It is the worst thing in this film, and it should be, I mean, kill it with fire. But that was an offcut from Four Weddings. Like, that scene of him talking to the waitress, that's from Four Weddings.
Caterer.
So yeah, the caterer. Yes, that's right. For talking to the caterer, it's from Four Weddings.
That's fair. So the only way that story makes any sense to me. So he's, of course, Chris Marshall is the guy who flies off to America because he's convinced he will be a sex god
Colin.
In America. Colin. Of course he's a Colin. And improbably picks up like four supermodels within 5 seconds of arriving in Wisconsin, of all places. Now, the only way that makes sense to me is just as a cartoon.
Yeah.
Like it just, like it has no business being in a live action film. It just doesn't make any sense.
It takes place in a different universe to the rest of the film as well. Like it's so ridiculous. And it's January Jones, isn't it? Ivana Milicevic, Alicia Cuthbert, isn't it? And then...
Shannon
Elizabeth as well.
Yeah. And, no, Christmas Jones herself from,
Oh, it's Denise Richards.
Denise Richards.
It's Denise Richards as well. So I didn't know where you were going with that. Christmas Jones. Oh, yeah, Christmas Jones. Yes, well, there's not enough. Yes, Denise Richards. Yes, it is Denise Richards.
But no relation.
No. But the whole thing with this, though, is like, and I know that this will come up, that, shall we say, the sexual politics of this film have... are maybe showing their age a little bit, but I think nowhere more so than here, because even in 2003, this was a bit, oh, come on, really? Like, this and the Hiker McCatch crotch shot, I think are probably the two most egregious examples of how time has passed.
I've seen a lot of people saying this because on social media, because obviously a lot of people are watching it this time of year. The amount of people are saying, oh, this hasn't aged well. Like things that were fine then aren't fine now. So most of the things in this were not fine then. Like Andrew Lincoln hitting on his best friend's wife wasn't cool then. It wasn't it wasn't nice and charming and it
was
suddenly
a different
in
time, Ollie.
It was not. It was the same time.
This is weird, actually, because, you know, this is a real point of discussion. You're absolutely right. People keep saying it was a different time. It's just aged badly, but it was perfectly okay then. It wasn't perfectly okay then. You're right. Many of these things raised an eyebrow immediately. But what's strange to me is actually how few of them were discussed in the reviews at the time. The biggest criticism of the film at the time was not, this is super creepy and filled with examples of incredible, egregious workplace harassment. The main criticism was, it's too schmaltzy and cute. I'm like, I'm sorry. Alan Rickman has a line where he says, if the girls in the office want their breasts unfondled, they should avoid Kevin. Why is Kevin invited to Christmas party?
Why does Kevin have a job?
Yeah. Why does Kevin have a job?
Why is Kevin not in prison?
So, you know, I think, some things we clearly used to joke about and now don't. And that has been, there has been a sea shift in attitude after, you know, Me Too and everything. There was a moment where things were joked about that are now taken more seriously. But a lot of this stuff, especially, yes, Juliet and Peter and Mark, the Andrew Lincoln, Keira Knightley story. I mean, come on.
That's a time thing. Because really, I don't think there's a problem with sexual politics there. Like, I don't think he's being...
No.
He's not sexually harassing her anyway. He's just being an awful friend and being wildly inappropriate. But, like, you know, it's not... I mean, it's creepy in a whole other way. I think, you know, the trailer where they've set it to horror music, that bit. Like, and I think that speaks volumes about that whole sequence.
I mean, what would anyone's reaction be if they discovered that someone had been videoing them in close-up all day? No one would think, oh, God, that's so sweet. You're just that obsessed with me and have never mentioned it and have always been horrible to me. Everyone would be terrified.
Yeah.
It's pretty bad. The fact that Andrew Lincoln survived this with his career and his reputation intact, I mean, speaks a lot to him personally. Well done, Andrew Lincoln. But like, you're right, that's some horror movie shit.
This is, even though I detest this film, other than Chris Marshall, whose performance I do not like at all, but you know, he doesn't have a lot to work with. There's no way of making that character charming. I like all the people in it. I think everyone does very well. I think they just do very well with absolute dreck.
But like, are there any, like, Ollie, you clearly have, shall we say, some issues with this, but like it's made up of a number of different threads. So obviously this was two films, wasn't it, originally? And tell me if I'm wrong, Helen, it was the Colin Firth storyline and the Hugh Grant storyline, wasn't
Correct.
It? They were two separate films. He had a meltdown and then turned it into this. And then it became a Christmas movie. But do any of the plot strands speak to you? Like, are there any redeeming ones for you?
None of them speak to me. I would say that it's certainly not original set. The Emma Thompson is the only one I would say works. That's the only one that seems like a relationship. My issue with this film, well, I have many, many issues with this film. My main issues with this film are, I love a rom-com. Like, I really liked Four Weddings. I really liked Notting Hill. I don't think this film is romantic. This is not a film about people falling in love with someone It's a film about people fancying people and wanting to have sex with them and finding out nothing about them. There is not a single conversation in this film that people have where they're like, oh, now I realise something about this person. It's making me fall in love. It's all, I've seen that person. They're hot. And I like them. The other, I'm not finished.
I'm sorry, Ellie, carry on.
The other thing I really, really, really hate about this Christmas film is that Christmas has nothing to do with anything.
Oh, whoa. There's a whole play, a whole nativity play.
Okay.
Plays a key role.
So, yes, it ends with a nativity play. Again, for no particular reason. But it starts off with this countdown of, 5 days till Christmas. So, like, what's happening at Christmas? And there's all these lines about Andrew Lincoln saying, it's Christmas and you tell the truth at Christmas.
That's not a thing.
Where's that come from? Everyone lies at Christmas. You get horrible presents and you pretend they're lovely. It just keeps shoehorning in all these things because that it's right at the beginning because, you know, it starts with Christmases all around.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I have a theory that scene is all about Richard Curtis taking the piss out of his audience because it starts off with Bill Nighy saying, why are we recording this rubbish? And his manager basically says, if you attach Christmas to any old shit, people would lap it up. And then this film proceeds. Doing exactly that.
Wow. That is cynical.
You've cracked it wide open.
It's right there in the text.
It's a cynical film.
It's a very cynical film.
But you mentioned there's Billy Mack and Joe. Like, I would say that is absolute evidence of a love that isn't about superficially fancying each other. It's when, you know, a one-sided, slightly abusive relationship, sure, but when he realises that the person that he loves is his manager, Joe. That's sweet. How do you not feel that?
A bit, although it does, correct me if I'm wrong and I've read it wrong.
Okay.
But it seemed like that seemed to start off with him realising he was actually in love with him. And then it was basically just, I really like you as a friend.
Oh, no, I never read it that way. I think, but maybe I'm, you know.
Only at the beginning, and I thought, that's kind of an interesting revelation. And then it was just like, we're mates. It's quite nice. It's fine.
I always got the impression that Joe was in love with Billy.
Oh, I didn't get that.
Billy was just wildly narcissistic. But
I think, and again, maybe this is just me, like a straight person, just missing a whole subtext. But I just always thought it was the two of them realizing that they had a platonic love, that they were the people who knew each other best, who spent most time together, who cared most, who looked out for each other's interests most, maybe not in the case of Billy. And, you know, and that was the best that either of them had in their lives.
Yes, correct. I think that's exactly what it is. But there's a bit at the beginning of that scene where he comes in and says, I realize, you know, you're the person I want to be with. I love you. I thought initially that's like it was going, I've been harboring this love that I didn't realize I had for ages. I thought, that's really interesting. It's still quite nice that he realizes that they're friends, but I mean, that is probably the most entertaining story. That one is the most entertaining story.
Yeah, I think that's the most overall successful story.
That could have been a film, I think, on its own.
Oh, it would have been quite a boring film. I'm not sure it would have survived stretched out over 90 minutes, but you never know.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say anything in this would survive stretched out over what 2 hours or whatever it is. And then the Emma Thompson one works. That's interesting.
She's amazing, though, isn't she?
She's brilliant. She's brilliant in it. I mean, still at times objectionable as a character, but she's very, very good in it. Pretty much everyone's very good in it. Alan Rickman manages to be not completely hateful as a completely hateful man.
Yeah, he does.
Who abuses his position as a boss and a husband.
Yeah, also true. Boo to you.
Yeah, someone throw him off a Nakatomi Plaza. All right, let's go through a couple of the other stories. I mean, the Colin Firth story is, I would say, the closest one to having two people fall in love, but only if you follow rom-com rules. Now, this is something that will probably get me shouted out on the internet, right? But I feel like there's an element of magical thinking required for a lot of rom-coms. And you have to assume that the two people on the poster are meant to end up together and that everything else is just essentially them telling the story of how they got together. And therefore, everything is okay because there's a sort of almost inbuilt consent, right? Now, I realize that's immensely problematic. I'm not suggesting anyone ever, ever, ever apply it to everyday life. It's not a thing in the real world. But in the rom-com world, maybe there is an actual connection there. Like, they are on the same wavelength. The film goes out of its way to show that multiple times.
What wavelength is it when they can't communicate? I feel like this is almost the most problematic because it's so catastrophically superficial. It's just like, you're hot, I'm hot, let's fuck. And that's basically all it can be.
No, but they are shown multiple times having exactly the same thought at the same time. Like, they talk to each other in their own language and the subtitle
the language
tells
of love.
Us. The subtitle tells us they're saying the same things. They are on the same
page. That is true. That
is
true. The subtitles tell us they're saying the same things.
Yes.
That is
true. It really needed a scene of them managing to communicate in a way that was more her working out what his book was.
Yeah.
And I agree with James, weirdly. I think this is this is one of the worst storylines because it really sums up the whole thing of it doesn't matter who you are. I just think you're hot. And suddenly want to marry you.
Yeah.
But only after we've done some cruel jokes about your overweight sister.
Yes.
Yeah,
that was
lovely. Unnecessary. That was like, you know, that made the jokes about Thor and Endgame seem positively cheery by comparison.
But those jokes are not as bad as the ones levelled at Martine McCutcheon for no reason whatsoever.
No.
And
I mean,
her
she is
apparently enormous thighs.
What is she? Maybe a size 10 in this film.
Possibly.
I mean, at most. And that's a UK size 10. A UK size 10 is like an American 6. She is maximum an American 6. And yet, people continually make a joke about her weight. I think it is meant to be a joke. I think the joke is meant to be, this is a clearly slim woman who people are still...
I'm not sure it is.
I don't think so, no.
My God, I hope so.
No, I don't think so. I didn't come across like that to me when they say, oh, the chubby girl. And she has the line about she basically broke up with her boyfriend because he was telling her to lose weight, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah.
And then suddenly Hugh Grant's assistant... Mm-hmm. Says the sorry, I haven't memorized any character names. I refuse to. They don't deserve it. There's too many of them. His assistant suddenly has the same reference of saying that she's got big thighs. I think it's just supposed to be that she is to some people seen as enormously fat.
Yeah, but I just thought that was the joke, that they were wrong.
No, I really don't think so.
I think if we were charitable, we'd say you're right. I think in reality, it's almost certainly not the case.
Oh, maybe I'm too charitable then. Okay, fine enough. But I mean. Yeah, that story is, I mean, in professional terms, the absolute most problematic. Mm-hmm. He literally fires her because he is attracted to her, not because of anything she's done.
Well, he's fired her also because he thinks that she's been flirting with the president. So
no, I don't think he thinks that. Because if in that case, why would he stand up to the president? I think he knows that she has been, like, if you look at the eye contact he's giving her while he's talking about taking a firmer stance with the US president, I think he knows that she was not consenting to anything the president was doing in that room. I don't think
rid of her, and then he's won over when he gets the card saying that it was all about him.
No, he gets rid of her because she was a distraction, because she made him do this very out of character thing that he's like, oh my God, what else could, like, what other effects could she have on me? Ah. And then is won over when she says that she's basically his for some reason.
I that's exactly my reading of it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, wow, we like it more than you do.
Either way, he should be, you know.
I mean, I know this isn't a political podcast, but there are people have stood down for a lot less than
I mean, not true. In the recent government.
No, in the current one. No. But
yes. But this is obviously the most famous. This is the most high profile of all the stories. It is the A plot, I guess, if you will, mainly because it's got Hugh Grant in it and it has him sashaying across the floor at various points, which is quite fun, dancing around number 10. And also the standing up to Billy Bob Thornton and, you know, rubbishing the special relationship has been much ballyhooed by you know, all manner of people. But wasn't it when Gordon Brown took over from Tony Blair that it became a big, this is what's going to happen?
Yeah, but there was talk about it for David Cameron as well. So I think people just like the fantasy of it quite a lot in this country. And that's why they Brexited. Anyway, not to get political.
It is the most charming storyline, I think. Even though it's, again, highly problematic, but the whole film is. It's not the most problematic one.
It is not, no. And he is very charming. This is Hugh Grant in super charming.
Oh, he's wonderful.
He's very good.
And she's very charming. So that, and there's a lot of talk in their flirtation about chocolate biscuits. So again, like, bonus points just there. Okay, how about Daniel, that's Liam Neeson, and his son Sam?
Yes, which just, I mean, it just kind of blows my mind that it's Thomas Brody Sangstone. He's like, what, six or something? I don't know how old he's supposed to be, but Christ. It's like when they did that Red Nose Day actually thing, and he's like, mm-hmm. however old he is, like 20 something. Again, it just, I mean, clearly I'm just not comfortable with the concept of people getting older. This is something that I can't quite wrap my head around, but it's like, it's you from Game of Thrones. Look, I love it. I think it's lovely, but I think, you know, and maybe it's because of partly what happened to Liam Neeson in real life, but just there's something really heartbreaking about that whole thread. Like, he has that real sort of hanged or just broken body language through it, that he's doing his best to look after this boy and he's kind of in pieces. And yes, sure, the Claudia Schiffer epilogue to that particular story is like having an anvil smack you in the face. But other than that.
But it's cute. I mean, again, I will allow cute, funny, silly jokes now and again. And I thought that was, you know,
Ringo is his god.
But they, I mean, I'm not sure. I've never tried to learn drums. I don't know if you could do that in, what, 2.5 weeks? And I'm not sure if, having only played the drums for 2.5 weeks, that they would recruit you for the concert.
It's the power of love, Helen. Yeah. It's the transformational power of love.
Oh, it's the power of fancying the popular girl who you've never spoken to and just like her because everyone else likes her.
I mean,
and then I think even the kid's as bad as everyone else, frankly, in his terms of his shallowness.
He just, yeah, he, I'm at that age, you can excuse it, I think.
Yes, okay. Yeah.
And, but it, and again, in fairness, at that age, were you able to talk to anyone? You know, you'd hear what they said in class. You'd maybe, like, be aware of them around the playground. You spent all these hours together every day. But, like, you couldn't just go and have a conversation.
No of course. But just the entire film has embittered me so that I can't even forgive a school-aged child for the shallowness of their feelings.
Unbelievable.
And Joanna, the object of his affections, who's played by Olivia Olsen, has gone on to big work in as a voice actor.
Actually, oh, really?
Yeah, she's in Adventure Time and things like that. Ah, so
Well done, so,
yeah.
Her.
Yeah.
And she had a hell of a voice.
She's a very good voice, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I do like the Daniel stuff. I think he plays that kind of grief thing really well. And I'm an absolute sucker for strong men trying not to cry in movies. I mean, Manchester by the Sea destroyed me, you know. I mean, why do you think I watched 15 seasons of Supernatural? Strong men trying not to cry every single freaking episode, I swear. It was amazing. Okay, here's my least favorite of the lot. Sarah, Carl, and Michael. So Sarah is Laura Linney, Carl is Rodrigo Santoro, and Michael is her brother. I hate this with a passion.
Is it because you would never knowingly kick Rodrigo Santoro out of bed, regardless of who fucking called you?
Who would? Look, take the phone off the hook and get on with it.
I feel like voicemail exists for exactly this reason.
It's so far-fetched, I won't believe it.
I cannot even, like, I
really understand the point of that one.
It feels
like it doesn't really. It's the of all of them. Yeah. It's the one, like, it gets to the point where, you know, we see that she goes and visits her brother in the hospital, and then nothing.
Yeah. Which this is a downbeat one, isn't it? It's a sad one. But then I suppose that's the Emma Thompson one. But it's not really
saying anything about relationships or, like, you know, oh, love can go wrong. It's really she takes someone back and it doesn't happen and then it just disappears.
But it's different kinds of love, isn't it? It's that she prioritizes the love for her mentally ill brother over the sort of man of her dreams, you know, and that's where her love is, that she, her family comes first for her.
Yes,
over
but
lust.
I feel like the thought can progress beyond that. Like, well, she has.
There were nine other stories, Ollie, you know.
Well, they weren't so doing much a whole lot either. But It didn't come to anything remotely satisfying, that one, I thought.
But there's a sort of mournful tone to it. Like, I find that it's quite sort of emotionally resonant. Like, you feel the conflict within her, to randomly quote Star Wars. Do you know what I mean? Like, you do, and you really feel for her, and the way, like, her brother is kind of, like, impulsively violent towards her when he sees her, and she just kind of takes it in stride because she's clearly very, very used to it. And I just, like, it's quite heartbreaking that she's someone who's clearly very lonely and is finding it impossible to hold down any kind of relationship or even, you know, function because she has this commitment to her brother.
And then the film's resolution is she just stays lonely.
Yeah. Because it's a truth bomb, Ollie. It's a truth bomb.
It's not a story. That's half a story.
I mean, I have a lot of, like, practical questions about the fact that, you know, he has like 24/7 access to his phone in that hospital. It seems unusual. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I haven't spent time in an institute for mental illness, but it seems unlikely that he would have absolutely unfettered access.
Because he's not. I don't think he's been some necessarily sectioned. I just get the impression he has to live in an assisted living facility because he's, you know.
Oh, it looks more hospital like than assisted living. He doesn't seem to be in like his own.
So what you are saying, actually, this is following up from the horror theme that he's like a convicted serial killer and it's a psychiatric hospital for the criminally insane, and it's all just really really dark and they won't let him out until
Arkham,
he
James.
Tells them where the bodies are buried.
I think he's shown to have genuine mental health issues that cause him to be violent, and he's clearly in a facility of some kind. Mm. And I agree with Helen. He would not just be able to be calling her all day. If he's violent, they're not going to. Yep, that's just not going to happen.
Yes, yeah. because this is where the suspension of disbelief ends, and not the Christmas angel in the shape of Rowan Atkinson.
Well, we'll get to that, but I do want to finish off on this because I think there is a story to be told here. There is a look at what carers do. Look how extraordinary carers are. Look at all the things they give up in their lives to take care of people who need it in our society. That's an absolutely, you know, wonderful thing to point out and a wonderful thing to be reminded of, especially at Christmas, and a wonderful group of people to kind of pay tribute to. But like, she's not his primary carer. She is, I guess, his emotional support. But it almost, the only way that it makes sense to me is if she is essentially almost as damaged and as in need of help as her brother is. Like, she's able to function in everyday life, but she is absolutely like codependent, it seems mm-hmm. like. She dials him on mm-hmm. several occasions. It's not just him calling her all the time. So, you know, there's a complete lack of boundaries. And again, voicemail exists, so you can get your rocks off with Rodrigo Santoro for like, I don't know how long it takes. I'm not going to speculate. I don't want to take our minds into the gutter. But a while, and then you call your brother afterwards and make sure he's okay. And then, you know, we'll see where the night takes you. No judgment.
It may make all three of us terrible people, but I mean, that was 100% just going to be left to ring. Like, there's just zero chance that phone was being picked up.
It just doesn't make any sense. I'm so upset still. It's only been 17 years. 18. Still not over it. Anyway, Colin, I don't think we should talk about anymore.
Kill it with fire. Kill it with fire. Yep. It's just the absolute worst. It is terrible.
It doesn't even make sense as a joke.
No.
Because the joke is that he thinks he's got a gift to women. Clearly isn't. He's horrible and a sex pest. And then he goes to America thinking that he's going to be God's gift to women. And he is.
Yeah. And
what's
he goes
the
there
joke?
And all American women are super hot and all sleep naked in one bed for warmth.
Yeah. Like, what's
and
the-
it's just...
What's
clearly, clearly, I think it's supposed to be, it's a send up of sort of like that kind of fantasy, isn't it? That ridiculous male fantasy, as well as that fantasy that maybe English men have that women in America will not be able to resist their accents.
It doesn't make sense as a joke for the deluded idiot to just go and have his delusions confirmed.
Confirmed, yeah.
Yeah.
It's bizarre.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of the best possible case for this. Okay, so I do have a friend who moved to America and said that essentially the accent seems to mean that everyone credits him with an extra 20 IQ points. You know, like just across the board, like he is assumed to be 20 IQ points higher than he is. Maybe there's an element of like it just gives you that air of sophistication and intelligence that Colin absolutely doesn't have, totally doesn't have. It makes no sense. It's terrible.
I was going to say you're being incredibly charitable to it.
I'm trying.
It's indefensible.
Just,
this is an indefensible storyline. I can't even. I will not.
And the fact that he comes back and then he not only comes back with another very attractive woman who is given no semblance of having a thought in her head, but he then brings a gift for his friend, who it's not like, well, get to know this person. It's immediately have a woman. So horrible.
It's awful. It's genuinely hateful.
Okay, so that one works for all of us. John and Judy. This is Martin Freeman and Joanna Page.
I love this.
So weird.
It's not weird. It's brilliant. This is absolutely delightful. I love the fact that they meet basically naked simulating sex, and then off camera they're all sort of very tentative and, you know, like nervous and whatnot. I just think it's a really sweet inversion, and I think they're very sweet together. I think it's lovely.
I like the idea. I've just found the execution so odd. So weirdly graphic.
Yeah, but again, but I think
in a way, I mean, obviously, no, this isn't, it's not made to accurately represent the film industry.
Sure.
But it was just very odd how much she was topless.
Yeah.
This film has a weird preoccupation with breasts. Like, there is a lot of nudity that has no reason to exist.
That is very true, actually.
Like, not just Laura Linney and Joanna Page, but also there's that exhibition that I think Andrew Lincoln's character is running, yeah. Just full of boobs.
Not in fairness, there are some male buttocks.
Yes, yep. There are some male buttocks. But it's just, it's really odd. And it was really jarring that in this kind of supposedly cuddly, fluffy Christmas film, it's suddenly, here's someone naked for ages. You know, the human body does not need to, you know, does not have to be a sexual thing. It should be existing in its natural form, whatever. But it's odd how tit heavy this film is. It was just let her keep her bra on, it's fine.
Yeah, and also, like, I just don't know, in terms of lighting, again, I'm not an expert in film lighting, I have not worked as a cinematographer, but, you know, if you were wearing nude colored underwear, wouldn't you still be able to get a pretty good read?
They're lighting skin, they're not lighting every single inch of your body, and she doesn't need to be for ages miming a blowjob. Yeah. She could just be kneeling in front of him. That's still funny.
It's inherently funny.
And put your boobs closer to his face. I found it weird.
It is weird. It's obscene and it's absurd and it makes absolutely no narrative sense whatsoever, but it's just funny. It's undeniably funny.
As nice as the idea was, it just felt, maybe I'm a huge prude, but it felt out of kilter with the rest of it.
It is the bit where if you're watching it with your parents, you suddenly get very interested in your book or something. You know, it's like, oh God.
I must admit, I don't find like any of that as obscene as the crotch shot. The crotch shot is the bit where, and I seem to recall, because I think Mark Como did a very long podcast with Richard Curtis about this film, because he loves it to bits, as all right-minded people do, Ollie Richards.
I fully respect Mark Como and I disagree with him.
But even Richard Curtis' own daughter has been like, Dad, what the fuck, over that scene with Heike McCatch and her opening legs.
I haven't worked in a lot of offices. I've been stuck working with you guys for most of my career. But, like, I don't know of many offices where you'd get people sort of sitting like that in front of their boss.
One of your French girls. Like, it's like, it's not accepted workplace behaviour. No.
And look, similar in terms of the workplace thing, you know, I feel like John and Judy nowadays would be able to go to the intimacy coordinator and suggest some changes in the onset behaviour of everyone involved.
Yes.
Yeah, but I do like, I am with James a little bit. I do like the contrast of that. I love the fact that we see them in the epilogue a month later. They appear to be just engaged and headed off somewhere by plane. And John saying, I might finally get a shag. So they are very pure. They are very, very, very innocent and pure people.
Yeah, I mean, I thought I took him as joking in that. But I do think I do definitely believe them as a couple. Yeah, and I do agree with James that it is nice that they are sort of very awkward and, you know, tentative around each other. I do think that works. I think it, for me, got the tone of it just slightly wrong.
Just a little slightly wrong. Have you ever sat down and mapped out all the relationships between everyone?
Good God, no.
I've never done it myself, but I have one because I Googled it and I do have a spider chart which shows how everyone is related. And it's only Billy Mack who's not actually connected to everyone except via their TV screens. Like, they all see, like, he's playing in the background a lot of the time in the other stories, but he's not narratively connected to them. But all the others are related.
As far as we know, none of the others know Ant or Deck.
No, that's true. It's 6 degrees of Ant or Deck.
But that makes sense. Like, if he was connected to any of them, then his resolution wouldn't work as well, would it?
Yeah, exactly that.
I say work as well.
Anyone else in his
gave it more credit than I meant to.
It didn't work.
No, actually, his resolution did work.
Yeah.
I'm Sam Clements, host of the 90 Minutes or Less Film Festival, another podcast in the Stripped Media family, a podcast that celebrates movies under 90 minutes long. Each episode, I'm joined by a special guest who selects a movie to join our prestigious lineup. Past guests have included fellow Stripped Media family members Martin and Sam from Song by Song, and Kobe from Flixwatcher, and Dave from The Wire Stripped. Search for us now on the app you're currently listening to this podcast, or join us at 90minfilmfest.com.
Okay, so the final story, and I hesitate to call it a story, is Rufus, is the Rowan Atkinson character. So in the commentary on this film, it was revealed that Rufus was meant to be a Christmas angel, which you kind of still get a little hint of, I feel like, in the film. And it's kind of a trope in a lot of Christmas movies. I mean, you'll all remember the character who's clearly Santa in the Princess Switch movies, right?
Of course.
All three of them, yeah. Correct, yes. But it's he's weird, you know. He's just, it's a funny just one-off joke that he's taking 16 hours to wrap a present.
But he does it very well because Rowan Atkinson is a god-level physical comedian, and I think that helps an awful lot. I think he's brilliant, and I think him turning up at the airport to let the wee in through to see his lady friend is lovely as well. I mean, yeah, it's not really a part, is it? He doesn't really have a role. It's just like he's kind of there and he's not. But I think he adds a certain something.
Yeah, totally. That's the scene of him wrapping up the present is probably the funniest scene in the film. I wish I didn't know he was supposed to be a Christmas angel, because that's given me a new thing to hate about this film.
Wow.
Because otherwise, I thought, well, it's just coincidence. There's this man who turned up and overheard the child's conversation and was trying to help.
He's magic.
I'm so sorry.
He didn't do anything magic.
I thought I could soften your stance on this, Ollie, and instead I've actually hardened your stance on that, actually.
I think the Rowan Atkinson is probably the only part I have no issues with.
Until now.
Yeah.
Until now. Oh, no.
It was in the original script and then they dropped it because I think they just thought it was stupid. But so I guess it doesn't really
and
carry
of course,
over.
As the Princess Switch shows, isn't stupid at all. It's totally sensible.
Oh, my God, doesn't it just? Yeah.
Right.
Now, did we, like we talked about all the stories, did we properly talk about the Alan Rickman, Emma Thompson one?
Well, I was about to circle back to Emma Thompson because I feel like I was going to ask you what the best bit is, but I feel like we're all just going to say the same thing. So what's the best Emma Thompson bit? Which is the same as saying the best bit.
It's the least original statement in the world. So it's the bit where she realizes that her husband has bought his office employee a necklace and she's getting a Joni Mitchell CD and then she just cries to herself.
Oh, it's just...
And it's Emma Thompson just being very, very good at acting.
Yeah, it really is.
Wow.
And moving cushions very movingly.
Yeah, really. And straightening the already straight bedclothes.
Yes, that's it. Sorry, maybe she didn't move cushions. Maybe it was only straightening the sheet. Yeah, she's brilliant.
She is brilliant. And just like the fact that he's made a mockery of her marriage. And it's just like, it's really like, oh, I mean, he's a real shit, isn't he?
He is
a real shit. But one of the things I do like that it plays quite well about him, what's about that story, is that he's a shit in that he fully just goes along with his secretary really fancying him. He doesn't just shut it down immediately. But the only saving grace they give it is that he doesn't go looking for it. Like, he doesn't...
She pursues
her.
Him.
Exactly. I mean...
I guess.
I get... I'm probably being as charitable as you were when you shouldn't have been.
Yeah,
but
I
think it gives it just an edge of possible... Well, I still think she should leave him, even if she doesn't at the end.
Yeah.
But it's not a total... He went out and betrayed her. I don't think we're led to believe that he has done anything other than bought this necklace.
Yeah.
Which is in itself terrible.
Yeah, which is awful. Which is so
but he hasn't
so
been
awful.
Having, but he hasn't been having an affair.
No, but he's very much considering
he
having
hasn't
one.
At all.
No, I don't think.
I don't think anything's happened. I think.
But it was clearly
my
going
understanding
to.
Of it. I don't even know. I don't even know whether I read it like that. I just read that he was so. He's completely wrapped up in this, the fact that this person fancies him and is just going along with it and being completely. Egotistical, but I never got the impression that he's done anything or necessarily is going to do anything.
I see.
Also, just as bad as buying the necklace is buying her a Joni Mitchell CD. The woman who says, like, not the fact that it's just a CD, but the woman who says she's loved Joni Mitchell for however many years, she's gonna have that CD.
She's gonna have those songs, yeah.
She's not going, oh, wow, what Joni Mitchell, I've never heard.
Yeah. He is clearly terrible at buying presents. And look, a lot of people are. I'm really struggling with present buying this year myself. But like a lot of people are very bad at buying presents. But that is God-level bad present buying.
That's pretty bad.
It really is.
Do we read the end? So I know there's much debate about what it means at the end. Like they are together at the airport. So do we take that as she stuck with him?
I think it's a... Is it your weekend with the kids? Kind of.
Is that how you read it?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
I've always thought she stuck with him.
Oh, I didn't.
I think it's exactly the scenario she outlined after the play, which is, you know, do you stick it out knowing that every day is going to be a little bit worse? I think that's where
I just assume that they were just kind of co-parenting and doing what they were supposed to do.
Oh, I read them still together, which again, if that is it, then that's,
see, another, that's even more bleak.
Another bleak ending of...
I mean, either is very bleak.
I don't know.
If she decides, like, putting the necklace aside, she realizes in that moment that this man does not know her.
Yeah. Mm.
So she's now living with a man who has no idea who she is. If she then decided she was leaving him, I'd be punching the air. It's like, good for you. Take half his money. He's clearly got loads.
Everyone in this film has.
It's true.
Everyone.
Even the quote unquote dodgy end of Wandsworth looks pretty damn nice.
It's still a nice house.
I live very near Wandsworth, and I've not noticed a dodgy end when I've been there. It could have ended with her. Part of the message could have been, love doesn't have to last forever. They could
love
have
yourself.
Had this... Exactly, Helen. That is better than any thought Richard Curtis had in this film. But it just instead, it seems to end on this bleak thing of, you just stick it out for the sake of the kids. Is that what is the message, that that's love for the kids? Because I think many studies have shown...
That in fact,
that's the
very
best thing
damaging.
To do for your children. Yes.
But it's showing lots of different facets of love. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work, sometimes it's dysfunctional, sometimes it's not.
No, I disagree. It's not really properly showing any facets of love. It's showing bits of facets of love.
Bits
and then
of
just leaving them before it's really done any exploration of them.
But it's so heartwarming, Ollie.
But okay. Tell me a romantic thing that happens in this film.
I just find all of it just delightful. Go on, Helen's got a hand up.
I have my hand up because the all you need is love at the wedding is romantic. Now, yes, he's overcompensating for the massive guilt he feels because he fancies his best friend's new wife. Okay, not a great motive, but that whole surprise at the end of the wedding is, I think, lovely.
I mean, yes, if you separate it entirely from motive.
Yeah.
Yes, okay. I'm doing that.
Yeah.
And admittedly, I'm also factoring in the fact that from everything we hear people say at the reception for this wedding, they have planned it very badly. So actually, Andrew Lincoln has helped them out by doing the one bit of the wedding that people will actually talk about positively and not the apparently extremely bad catering or the terrible DJ. So, you know.
Yes.
You got one thing right.
But it's not a romantic gesture in the sense that
it's
purely for the good of someone else.
Yeah.
Purely for the good of someone else. Laura Linney thinks she is, I guess.
So, yeah, this is why I dislike this film. It pretends it's incredibly romantic and nothing romantic happens in it.
I don't know. I think even if we gloss over the superficialness of the Colin Firth storyline, that is like, that still gets me when it goes to the restaurant and it's the whole thing. I still think that's lovely. Even if you take apart the fact they've never had a proper conversation.
No, I disagree. It's like, it's like proposing to someone at a wedding. It was a big look at me gesture. He goes to this woman who has no idea that he's supposedly in love with her, having had no conversations whatsoever, knowing nothing about her other than he likes her in her bra and pants.
But they finish each other's sandwiches.
You're mixing films. Frozen is more romantic than this.
And that relationship, if you remember,
it doesn't end well.
Yes.
Very bad.
But he goes to this woman who, for all he knows, has not thought about him a day since they split up. Not split up, went their separate ways from their holiday home where she was working for him. And he goes and, like, in the middle, of, in front of everyone she works with, everyone she knows, he asks her to marry him. It's not romantic because it's for him.
But
it's not for her. It turns out to be for her because Richard Curtis has made this total, he's just picked out of the air that she's also in love with him, has been learning English. But there is no basis for it.
Okay,
it's just moments that don't connect to any human feeling.
Okay, but like Sleepless in Seattle, you know, romance, they've never met, they've never really interacted, they've never had a conversation, but we buy it because these characters have been shown to have an almost mystical connection and we just think they're going to end up together, even if some reviews would disagree with me. But it's like that. And they've both, independently, they've had the same thoughts at the same time. They've both gone and learned the other person's language very badly in an attempt to, you know, be able to communicate them with them at some point in the future.
Do you know the key part of what you just said, Helen? We've been shown.
Yeah, but it's a film. We're always shown everything.
No, I mean, we've been shown in Sleepless in Seattle that they have a connection. In this, we've been shown that they talk about the same things, but they don't share a connection because they have no idea they're saying the same things.
Yeah.
It's been shown that they like each other, but they've had neither of them has a sense that the other one likes them. They don't realize they're falling in love.
Being charitable, you're supposed to assume that this connection they have transcends language barriers, and there's just something sort of like spiritual, like they're soulmates or something, and not just like he had a look at her ass and went, you know.
But again, I'm totally up for that. Show me. Demonstrate it. Don't just tell me that this is romantic because they're supposed to fall in love. Show me these people falling in love.
Look, Richard Curtis is many things. I would say a nuanced, subtle filmmaker is maybe not one of them.
I've said this many times. I think Richard Curtis is a brilliant writer who should not be allowed to direct his own scripts. Because I don't think, and I don't mean that that's not supposed to be bitchy. I think he writes fantastic scripts. But I don't think, as a director, he doesn't kill his babies, basically. Mm. He doesn't take out the stuff that doesn't need to be there. Like, all his films are incredibly long because he just leaves everything in.
Which story would you lose first, apart from Colin?
Obviously Colin, yes.
We're going to get it down to 8 stories. We've taken Colin straight out. What else?
This is a good game. I like this game.
Well, I would lose them in their current form.
Yeah.
Then lose Laura Linney because it does
Laura
nothing.
Yeah, I absolutely would.
I would lose Laura Linney. You'd lose the Colin story. You'd lose Laura Linney.
And you give everybody else a few, you know, HR lectures.
Because I wouldn't lose the Keira Knightley, Andrew Lincoln one, because I think it's like you need that particular hate thread in there. I think it wouldn't be Love Actually without the hate one.
But we're not supposed to hate it.
Oh yeah, I know we're not, but I think, you know, I like it and hate it in the same way. I remember reading an interview with Keira Knightley where she talks about why she wears that ridiculous fucking hat, you know, like the flat cap that she's wearing, or the beret, whatever it is. And she said,
she had a massive
spot on her forehead, so she has the hat pulled down to cover this spot, which is apparently the biggest spot she'd ever had in her life. And so
it was a decision. Oh, it was a decision on the day that they just
give her a hat.
And I think she's, because she was 18, wasn't she? She said that's what happens if you cast teenagers to play.
Let's not even get the age question is also not
every.
I looked
it up, and I think the minimum age gap between man and woman, not counting Thomas Brodie Sangster, was 12 years.
That's the minimum.
That's the minimum. Like, Laura Linney is older than Rodrigo Santoro. Mm.
Oh, so that's the exception to the rule.
Yes,
is it?
But all the others, it's over a decade in difference.
Mm. Not great.
It's not great.
Okay, but we really like Emma Thompson.
We do.
So
we
Love
do.
Actually remains a Christmas classic.
Yes. Hang on, what? I did not agree to that
section of the podcast.
Okay, I'm not ordaining this. I'm just describing the situation, because that does seem to be the case, because it still seems to be wildly beloved in a way that I really don't
understand.
It
is my absolute,
myself.
If we're not counting Die Hard, which we absolutely should, which is the greatest Christmas movie, but if we're
not counting Die Hard,
have you done your
you?
Die
no
Hard
one's
episode
arguing.
Yet, Helen? Have you done
no,
that
No, I'm
one?
Saving it for a really, like, a rainy day. Yeah.
If no one argues that Die Hard's not a Christmas film, except people who want to argue that it is.
That's true.
No one else cares.
The Princess Bride is a Christmas film. You don't hear me going on about it endlessly. Yeah,
I mean, Lethal Weapon is a Christmas film. But anyway, this is a whole other thing.
Yeah.
But this is my favourite Christmas movie. Like, this is the one that I like to watch at Christmas. So
good
Lord.
Insane.
I mean, didn't Elf come out pretty much the same year as this? And Bad Santa?
I like Elf. I got time for it. But I couldn't rewatch Elf the way I rewatch this. I just find this lovely.
I genuinely don't understand it. So I have many friends who love Love Actually, and I just won't talk about it with them, because, you know, let people like what they like. I'm only slagging off here because this is the point of this podcast.
Exactly. You were invited with that aim in mind.
Otherwise, I don't want to have a discussion with people to tell them that they can't like Love Actually. Fine. Go ahead. I hate it, but you do you. You enjoy your absolute tripe.
Does the missing comma upset you?
No, because it's not apparently.
Wasn't it used to be that? I seem to recall from writing news stories about it before it came out that it was at one point love, comma, actually, and then they dropped the comma.
I think that was a misunderstanding.
It doesn't annoy me because my favourite film is Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and that doesn't have a question mark, so I've made my peace with punctuation.
You've made your peace with it. Okay, fair enough.
Rather than draw attention.
Exactly. Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Exactly.
It's just like, it's the end of a sentence, isn't it?
Yeah, okay. So, okay, Love Actually, you've got some explaining to do, and frankly, some very, very difficult conversations ahead with HR. Mm. But in the meantime, thank you, Ollie, and thank you, James. It has been educational. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You are welcome.
But and still, Merry Christmas to you both, regardless of whether I agree with you.
Well, that's it for this episode of Bah Humbug. Please join us next time for more Christmas movies madness. In the meantime, I've been your host, Helen O'Hara. This podcast is edited by Ben Williams and produced by Kobe Omanaka for Stripped Media. And if you've enjoyed the pod, please do rate us with 5 shiny Christmas stars wherever you listen to your podcasts. But whatever you do, happy holidays!
Just heard a Stripped Media production.